listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrick. Coming up, the sting of the Brewers' Game 7 loss to the Dodgers in the National League Championship Series has probably worn off a little bit. Coming up, we'll let you weigh in with your favorite moments of the season and your hopes for next year. First, between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide offices and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time or The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews on wisconsinvote.org. Today, we talked to Sarah Godlewski, a Democrat running to be Wisconsin's state treasurer. She's the co-founder of the venture capital firm Massa Partners. Sarah Godlewski, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to talk about the existence of the Office of Treasurer. In past elections, we've talked to candidates who wanted to eliminate the office. Yeah. There was this campaign to end it. Voters rejected a constitutional amendment. You were working to keep it. Talk about why you want there to be a state treasurer of Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's exactly how I got involved in the state treasurer's race, is that being in business and finance, Rob, my entire career, I was completely appalled that we were going to get rid of our financial office, our independently elected financial office. That's like, you know, in my world, firing your chief financial officer and firing your auditor and giving those responsibilities to a CEO. We would never do that in business. So why do we think that would be good government? And was part of the leaders for that bipartisan fiscal watchdog group. And in traveling the state, talking about what the state treasurer should or could be doing, it just became clear that this office has been neglected for well over a decade. And that's why I decided to throw in my hat and run for it, because I really know it can make a difference for Wisconsin.
Not just neglected, but specific tasks of the state treasurer have been separated from that office and put elsewhere. What do you see as the role of the state treasurer, given the limited tasks at hand?
Yeah, there are three things I believe this office should be doing for Wisconsinites. The first is that this office should be a fiscal watchdog. I mean, currently in our government, the governor and the legislature, they tax you. They then tell you how they're going to spend your money, and then they spend your money and they account for it. This is like a violation in internal controls and finance 101. I mean, it's kind of like the fox watching the hen house kind of thing. And so what this office should be doing, because it has nothing to do with the budget process, it has nothing to do with taxation, is it should come in and say, did your tax dollars, were they spent the way that they said they would be? And currently that's not happening. The second thing that this office should be doing is it should be your financial advocate. Do you remember that when Wells Fargo kicked people off of their loans and raised their interest rates? So state treasurers around the country were saying, you can't do that to our people. And so they literally fined them, they canceled financial agreements. And in Wisconsin, when that happened, we did nothing. And then the third thing that this office should be doing is it should be investing in Wisconsin's future. So the state treasurer is the financial trustee to four trust funds worth over $1.2 billion. And that money goes to public schools. So last year alone, it provided $35 million to all public schools, specifically for books and technology, which I think are pretty darn important things that our kids need. And so what this office helps to do is figure out, well, how should that be invested? And so one of the things that we've been talking about is like win-win investment strategies. So we can use, for example, part of that fund to refinance student loan debt. Student loan debt was up to 14.75% in interest rates last year. So how can young people, like, you know, keep ahead if they can't even keep up, kind of thing?
With that second point you mentioned, financial protection and enforcement,
yeah,
would the legislature have to do something to put that in the purview of the state treasurer?
So my belief is that this is an independently elected office and they need to use the bully pulpit appropriately. And so I think advocating financially is exactly what this office should be doing. So bringing this awareness to whether it's the legislature. I mean, another thing under financial advocacy is that the aging agency in the state of Wisconsin, the number two reason they get a call is for financial exploitation of our seniors. I mean, this is a place that which could, you know, be a one-stop shop to advocate for seniors so they're not victims of financial abuse again and again, which is what's happening.
Talking to Sarah Godlewski, Democrat running to be Wisconsin's state treasurer. We've talked about why have the office, what it should do. How about why you?
Yeah. So it was never my dream, Rob, to run for state treasurer. I wasn't somebody drawing like safety deposit boxes or, you know, making dollar signs when I was a kid. But as a proud product of Wisconsin public schools, you know, when you see something that's wrong, you got to stand up and say something. And so I've been doing business and finance my entire career. I actually started my career doing micro lending in rural parts of the country. And then from there, I actually started working for Fortune 100 companies and large federal agencies. Most notably, I worked for the Undersecretary of Defense, and we looked at kind of how to do things more efficient and effective and cut through red tape and actually save taxpayers tens of billions of dollars when I was there. I then became the director of strategy and performance for one of the largest growing municipalities, so at that local level, and helped to create a performance-based budgeting process. And today, I am the co-founder of a socially responsible investment firm. We invest in early-stage socially responsible businesses. So whether it's accounting or investing, I mean, I've been doing business and finance, exactly what this role should be doing, my entire career. And as a fifth-generation Wisconsinite, I would now want to do it for my state.
And you've said elsewhere, I think that you think the role, the state treasurer, could have an environmental component. What would that be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the state treasurer helps to oversee almost 80,000 acres of public land. This land is what's responsible for timber management, and about a lot of the revenue actually from timber management goes to the Common School Fund. And so there is kind of an environmental aspect. It's helping to oversee those 80,000 acres and ensure sustainable timber management and financial returns on that. And so that's kind of a unique aspect that a lot of people just aren't aware of.
And you could be, there's a lot of ways an election could come out. It could be that you're a Democrat in the office of state treasurer working with a Republican governor or Republican chambers in the legislature. Do you think you could be an effective partner even if your party isn't controlling any of the other branches of government?
Absolutely. I mean, my motto throughout this campaign has been money's not red or blue, it's green. And so we need to make sure this office works for all Wisconsinites. I mean, I started even getting involved by leading a bipartisan coalition with the former Republican state treasurer, Jack Voight, and I traveled the state talking about this. When I was at the Pentagon, I worked across the aisle all the time to get things done. So working across the aisle is something that I've been doing my entire career. And I think it's a really important job to ensure that we serve all Wisconsinites in that way.
And in the 3 points you mentioned earlier, a lot of that, as you said, could be done looking at the office as a bully pulpit.
Yep.
Are there specific tasks, responsibilities that you would like to see legally returned or added to the office of the state treasurer?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I guess there would be a couple of things. One is the state treasurer used to lead the EdVest program, which is a 529 savings account. And when Jack Voight actually took that program over, he helped make it a really effective program. And I think that's something that this office could do. It used to have a seat on the pension board. It used to manage unclaimed property. So I think that these are all things that would be helpful for it to continue to be a successful office, but aren't critical. Right, Rob? I mean, I think it goes back to this vision about what the state treasurer should do as being a fiscal watchdog, to being a financial advocate, to investing wisely, are things that this can start on day one and doesn't need to wait for some sort of legislation to move forward.
As we wrap up, there are a lot of high-profile races going on, races for governor, U.S. Senate, the legislature. Treasurer might not be top of mind for a lot of people. What would you say to voters as to why they should vote for you, but why they should be concerned about who the state treasurer is?
They should be concerned because we're seeing firsthand what happens when we don't have an effective state treasurer. I mean, a couple weeks ago, we were reading in the paper how $47 million were missing from the Department of Transportation budget. These were areas like Eau Claire and Green Bay and Dane County where you're needing to improve our roads, which is a big topic in this election season. And when we ask, no one knows where that money went. This is exactly why we're seeing that you need to elect an independent person who can come in and say, where did that tax money go and why?
Sarah Godlewski, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Godlewski, Democratic candidate for Wisconsin State Treasurer. Travis Hartwig, a Republican candidate in that race, is scheduled to join us at this time tomorrow. Between now and the November 6th general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide offices and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You can find all these interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at wisconsinvote.org. Coming up, the Brewers' fantastic season came to an end on Saturday. We want to hear from you about that magical ride. How do you feel about the team's success this year? Did you go to any of the playoff games? And what are your hopes for next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. First, the most exciting Milwaukee Brewers season in decades came to a close on Saturday night. They lost to the Dodgers 5-1 at Miller Park in Game 7 of the National League Championship Series. Well, fans are disappointed. Some experts, some baseball fans, say there's a lot to celebrate and be optimistic about for next year. We want to hear your thoughts on the season and the future at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the team's success? Do you have a favorite memorable moment of the season? Did you go to the postseason games, watch them, listen to them? What was the atmosphere like for you? Are you hopeful for maybe a World Series appearance if we wait till next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Central Time producer and Brewers superfan Bill Martins is here. Hey, Bill.
Hey there.
Have you recovered from the heartbreaker on Saturday?
Yeah, Saturday was kind of a rough evening. I was kind of hacked off and depressed at the same time. And then, you know, I was telling you earlier this morning, so I could have gone out and watched the game, but I wanted to listen to the radio broadcast and hear Euchre go nuts when they actually, you know, won the whole thing. So I'm listening to this, and when Yasiel Puig of the Dodgers hit that three-run shot, I don't know, in the sixth inning or whatever, and then the Brewers didn't answer with anything in their half of the inning, I had to turn it off because I was getting way too frazzled. Then I was checking on my phone, for the next couple of hours. When I saw that there were two out in the bottom of the ninth, I totally cut that thing off, and I didn't find out for sure that they had lost until about 11:15 Sunday morning.
All right, we'll hear more of your Brewers story, Bill. I want to bring in Randy in La Crosse now. Randy, hi.
How you doing?
Good. Did you watch?
Oh, my God, did I watch. With enthusiasm and enjoyment. I went to the last game of the 30th of the season, so I haven't actually seen a lost game from the Brewers. I went to the first Thursday game, and then I went to the first Monday game of the National. It was just incredible. I have such good memories. My dad was, it was the last time that my dad saw a game was in with the Brewers, so. It was just incredible for me to see that game.
That's
great. I love the Brewers. I think that next year, watch out.
Yeah, I agree.
Randy, thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. And Bill, what's this season been like for you as a Brewers fan?
This was the most fun season that I can ever remember. I mean, I was 1 year old when they went to the World Series in 1982. My memories are a little foggy, you know, personal memories of that one. But they've had a few good years since then. Most of their years, you know, were kind of bad to average at best, quite frankly. They've really gotten better over the last few years. And if you would have told me way back in February that, hey, the Brewers are going to be one win away from going to the World Series, I would have said, you have no idea what you're talking about. You're crazy. That's not going to happen. But here they are. It was such a great ride. So many great moments during the season to cheer about. How could you not have a great time?
Let's go back to our callers now. Jim is with us in Bloomer. Jim, hello.
I'm a huge Brewer fan, went to a bunch of games this year. I unfortunately did not have a chance to go to them in the postseason, but the only thing that I would change is I really feel sorry for the guy. It was Jeffers. I do not understand why Council brought in Jeffers with he did not prove himself over the last 2-3 weeks of the year where he struggled, and he did it again. You took us from 2-1, and it was just, it just like deflated everything when he let those three runs on that home run. It was very disappointing, but you know, hey, I'm not putting the Brewers down, but I just really do feel sorry for Jeffers because he had struggles in the last 2-3 weeks of this year, and boy, that really cost us in Game 7.
And Jim, do you have high hopes for the 2019 season?
Oh, huge, huge, especially with Arcia. You know, the way he started to come on in postseason, I think he could definitely cause a lot of damage next year. And with the core nucleus that we have in place right now, I think if you bring everybody back, I think we could definitely go farther.
Jim,
go to the World Series all the way, baby.
All right, Jim, thanks for the call. We are taking your calls about the Brewers season, one game away from the World Series. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a lifelong, maybe long-suffering Brewers fan? What was this season like for you? What was it like watching them in this playoff run? And Do you have, like Jim did, high hopes for next year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. And Bill, talk a little more about that. Most of these guys are staying put.
Yeah, I was reading an article earlier this morning, and I think they only have 4 unrestricted free agents, and none of them are really, you know, super important core players. I think Wade Miley, one of their starting pitchers, was probably the biggest name on that list. And from what I was reading, it looks like Cincinnati may make a play on him because they need a left-handed starter, and that's where he began his career. He was a rookie of the year there, went into the American League for a couple of years, and just didn't do well. Then the Brewers brought him in, and he was incredible this year. But other than that, yeah, everyone is pretty much staying put, like Yelich and Kane and Hader and Knebel, Jeffress, who our caller mentioned earlier, who was unbelievable in the regular season, struggled in the postseason. But all these guys are coming back, and their starting rotation looks like it could be really good because they've got a lot of young arms in their bullpen who should be starting pitchers. And you know, Council didn't put them in the bullpen intentionally. They just kind of wound up there. So they have a lot of options. And yeah, I read a USA Today column this morning from someone who thought that she would actually be surprised if the Brewers didn't make the World Series next year. So that's pretty bullish.
And that's got to make it easier to keep a team together, too. When you're like, oh, a team in a rebuilding year, that free agency contract somewhere else might look good.
Yeah.
If you're a team that's knocking on the door of the World Series, it's a lot easier to keep people.
Every player wants to win a ring. And if you're this close, I mean, why wouldn't you want to stick around? Right.
Well, yeah. Well, we have a conversation going over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I want to share a couple of the comments there. Chris writes, just be glad they came this close. The ride was fun. Pat writes, it was a wonderful season. We will be back. So despite the end of the season, Bill, and it's got to end sometime, it didn't end in the World Series.
Right.
This is one that Brewers fans are going to look back on pretty happily.
Absolutely. Like I was saying before, there were so many years where, you know, you were just happy if they finished 500, you know, 81-81. Now we get to within one game of the World Series, and obviously it was so disappointing to lose that Game 7. You're so close, and now you got to wait a whole year before the next World Series comes around, and I feel like it's going to take forever for next fall to come around. But you know, it was also a lot of fun for some individual players as well. Christian Yelich hit for the cycle twice this year,
which is not a thing that happens. Was that a first ever?
I think a very small number of other players have hit for the cycle multiple times. I think he was the first player.
That means a single, double, triple home run.
Exactly, in the same game. I think he was the first player to hit for the cycle against the same team twice, and he did it in about 3 weeks. And statistically, hitting for the cycle is more rare than a no-hitter. So this is really, really rare stuff, and Christian Yelich did it twice. He'll probably be the National League MVP. Josh Hader struck out 8 guys in 2 2/3 innings against the Cardinals back in April. I think he was the first player whoever did that. So they just had a lot of great individual performances, and of course the team as a whole. You know, there were a lot of times where we were done talking about the Brewers by September. It's
right.
Like, bring football on. I'm so glad the Brewers were able to hang on to this for a while and make it interesting.
Talking about the Brewers' playoff run, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the season, your hopes for the future, or chime in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A couple more comments here, Bill. Eric writes, well, this is a nice thing for those poor folks at L.A., really have nothing else going for them. Hopefully this will bring some glimmer of joy into their empty little lives. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to get a bag of sour balls and pick out the grape ones.
Wow.
And James writes, simply, go Red Sox.
You know, I was telling my wife that. I'm like, man, I hope the Dodgers just sweep the Red Sox. I hope Manny Machado strikes out 16 times and commits 5 errors.
Wait, you're hoping the Red Sox wipe out the Dodgers?
Yes. Sorry.
Okay,
if I
you
said
it backwards there. I was like surprised at you there.
Yeah, no, I to the extent that I care, I want the Red Sox to win this.
Okay, and I'm sure other people will join in over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. So 1982, was that the last time the Brewers were in the World Series? Do I have this right?
Right, it was 1982. That's when they were still in the American League. And, no, What happened? Yeah,
they're in the American League then. Yeah,
yeah, they were. They lost to the St. Louis Cardinals
in Game 7.
Right, exactly. They had beaten the California Angels to go to the World Series. And actually, I think it was just a couple of days ago. It wasn't actually on Saturday, but it was right around that time. It had been like the anniversary of when the Brewers got knocked off in that Game 7, in that World Series game. So, yeah, it was just kind of a... hopefully next time around we don't have to worry about losing another Game 7.
Right. Now, one thing that's been unique about this Brewers season is, and you're kind of alluding to this earlier, the paint by numbers pitching. One pitcher might pitch two innings or one batter in one case.
Right, they did that a couple times.
And you know, you might see five. I'm a little old fashioned. I think, you know, can't we get starting pitchers that can reliably go six innings, innings?
Well, Craig Counsell's philosophy is, and you look at the analytics, you look at the stats, and statistically speaking, a pitcher's third time through the lineup, the odds of success begin to favor the hitter. And so Counsell's just like, you know what? I'm not even going to deal with that. I'm just going to bring in a fresh arm and keep the other team honest. And so that's why a lot of the Brewers starters weren't going that long. And then a couple of times, I forget which game it was. I think it was the last one in Los Angeles, so I guess Game 5. He brought Wade Miley in to pitch to one batter, although no one really thought that was the plan. And he put Miley out there so that Los Angeles would put more right-handed hitters up. So then he pulls Miley out after the first batter, brings in a lefty, and now all of a sudden, or brings in a righty, now all of a sudden the Dodgers lineup is all screwed up because they don't have the right, you know, batter-pitcher matchups there. So that's kind of... He's been playing that for most of the last half of the season, and it's, for the most part, it's worked out pretty well for them.
So you're coming into 2019 season really excited, Bill.
I am. I can't wait for the season to begin. I hate that this season is over, but you know, let's get this next one underway. I think they're gonna be even better, and it very well may be their year.
All right, we'll hold you to that, Bill. Thanks a lot for coming over to the studio. That's Central Time producer and Brewers superfan Bill Martins. Thanks for your calls and your comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Still time for you to chime in there, by the way. What did you think of the season? What are you looking forward to in 2019? By the way, pitchers and catchers report to spring training on February 13th, just 114 days away. Bill told me that. Now, most of us like to be winners, and many of us like to play games. The author of a new book says, personal finance can be less intimidating and boring if we look at it as more of a game with rewards to follow. She says money gets a bad rap, and we often consider it to be what stands between us and our dreams, but she says it doesn't have to be that way if we have the knowledge and understanding to feel control of our money. Kristen Wong has written about personal finance and the economy for the New York Times, NBC News, Forbes, and more. She's the author of the new book, Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, it seems like one of the biggest obstacles when we think or talk about money is that we don't really want to think or talk about money. Why is this a subject a lot of us want to avoid?
Well, I think from a young age, we're kind of discouraged from talking about it. Like, it's just not something polite you discuss at the dinner table, right? You know, and money is also very intimidating for people. There's a lot of judgment surrounding it. A lot of us have financial shame from past money mistakes. So there are a handful of reasons why we want to avoid talking about money. The problem with that is it's really hard to learn about something when you don't talk about it, right?
Is there a thing where people who are grown-ups think, I'm a grown-up, I should know this stuff by now. Everybody else has this under control. I don't. What's wrong with me?
Exactly. I think that's probably the main reason most of us want to learn about money and understand money in the first place is we think, well, you know, I'm in my late 20s, I'm in my 30s, I'm in my 40s. I should have my financial life together by now. Let's get this thing going. But that's actually a really boring and terrible reason to want to get money in the first place, right? Because when push comes to shove and you're trying to cut back and you're trying to make good financial decisions, let's say, you know that you shouldn't splurge on this fancy restaurant dinner that your friends want to go to. Well, it's going to be really hard to say no to that if the only reason you're saying no to that is so that you can be a responsible adult. You know what I mean? If you have a reason for wanting to understand money and a reason for wanting it in your life, then I think that just puts you in a totally different position where you have now a reason to say no because you give yourself something to say yes to.
And that's a big part of your book, looking at motivation. So as you say, instead of I want to save money because I feel like I should save money. You say people should figure out a goal so that they have something concrete in mind when they're saving that money. So what kind of things are you talking about?
Well, when I say a goal, I just mean something that is specific and meaningful to you that you want to use your money for. What do you want to use your money for? It can be something, it can be stuff, right? Like you might want to buy a new car. I don't know. It could be an experience, like maybe you want to save up for an epic trip to Europe or something. Or you can buy yourself a feeling. Like I know when I was in student loan, I really wanted to get out of it because I got tired of feeling weighed down by that debt. And I really wanted to feel like, you know, I could use my money however I wanted to, move into a bigger place, whatever it was. But I wanted to buy the feeling of liberation, I guess, you know? So I think it just really comes down to getting clear about why you want to have a good relationship with money. Why do you want to get your financial life in order? And really understanding what those reasons are so that you can work toward them.
Talking to Kristen Wong, her new book is Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. And you're pitching this book, Kristen, not just to people who already have money to manage. You're trying to talk to people, I think, at a lot of different levels of the economic spectrum, including people who are having trouble making do on a day-to-day level. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the book, you know, I talk about a lot of, you know, it is for people at different levels in their financial life. There are a lot of, I talk about debt in the book and options you have if you're really struggling with debt, because I think it's harder than ever to get out of debt for a lot of people, and something that they think they're going to be saddled with forever. So, you know, I think it's important as personal finance writers and reporters to kind of talk about those options as well, because a lot of people really do struggle to get by financially on a day-to-day basis. I think a big part of it is, is psychological too. You know, you can, a lot of times, you know, I've been writing about money for the past 5 or 6 years, and one thing I always hear people say is, why don't they teach this stuff in schools? If I just learned this in school, I'd be good with money. Well, that's not necessarily true, you know? Financial knowledge is one part of the equation. The other part is, this is really about your habits and your behavior. So that's a big part of what my book is about, is I really talk about the psychology behind why it's hard to understand money, why it's hard to get personal finance. You know, it's not just the knowledge. You can do all the math and learn all the money rules and learn how 401ks work, but if you don't have some control over your habits and your behavior and your mindset, it's going to be very difficult to put that knowledge into practice.
Well, let's start putting it into practice. So say we have the idea, okay, a budget, that sounds like a good thing, one of the basics. How can we, if we're not budgeting now, how can we start a budget that we're actually going to, you know, keep track of and actually stick with keeping track of for not just a day, but weeks?
Well, one kind of controversial method. A lot of personal finance experts talk about this, and one that I interviewed in my book says, you know, get rid of budgets altogether.
Huh.
Have a spending plan instead. I will let you in on a secret, Rob. A budget and a spending plan are pretty much the same thing. But a spending plan is just that. It's a plan for your money and how you're going to use it, but with one crucial difference. In that you have a goal for it. You have something you're working toward, whether it's saving, you know, paying off a $10,000 loan so that, like I said, you could move into a bigger place, or, you know, in my case, you could move out of your mother's house. Or maybe it's saving $5,000 for an amazing trip to South America. With a spending plan, it's goal-based. So your goal is the main thing driving all of your financial decisions. And I think just having that, you know, can really help you actually stick to a budget. So again, when you go to those really tough money decisions where you have a choice of saying yes or no, you're going to say yes to your goal. So you're going to make better decisions that support you instead of, you know, you're going to feel like money is working for you instead of the other way around.
And you write that one of the obstacles to sticking with a budget or a spending plan, whichever one we want to call it, is that impulsive moment. And you give some sort of practical advice on how to maybe rethink those impulsive purchase decisions. Can you share a couple with us?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So that's a big part of sticking to a budget, is like impulsive spending, emotional spending, stress spending. And I think just understanding the weird ways in which your brain works against you is a big step in the right direction. And there are a lot of like cognitive biases that kind of again, weird ways our brain works against us, there are a lot of cognitive biases that get in the way when it comes to money specifically. One of them is the sunk cost fallacy. And with the sunk cost fallacy, it's basically when you you keep making a decision that might not be the right decision because of time or resources, money that you've already invested in that decision. This comes into play with investing a lot, but it also comes into play with day-to-day spending decisions. I will give you a personal example. If you are, let's say that you have it in your head that you need to go to IKEA and get, you know, this little nightstand or something you saw online. You drive all the way to IKEA, you fight for parking, you go through their little the rat maze that is IKEA, and you discover they don't have the table you want, but you came all this way, you fought for parking. You know, you have to buy something. I don't want to show, you know, I can't leave here empty-handed. So then you spend $300 on a bunch of stuff that you might not necessarily need and didn't really budget for because of that sunk cost fallacy.
We're talking to Kristen Wong. Her new book is Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you talk with, I don't know, friends or loved ones about money and finances, or do you steer clear of that kind of conversation? Do you feel overwhelmed when it comes to dealing with money? Have you found budgeting ideas that help keep you on track? Do you have questions about how to get motivated and maybe start that budget or spending plan? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Kristen Wong. She's been writing about money and personal finance for years for the New York Times, MSN Money, Forbes, and more. Her new book is Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you shy away from talking or even thinking about money? Is your financial situation sort of a monster in a closet or file cabinet you'd rather leave undisturbed? Or did you move from there to maybe taking on money issues? What did you do? What worked for you? What works for you? Have you set a budget? Or do you have questions for our guest about getting motivated when it comes to mastering our money? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kristen, you write about how and when and why to have an emergency fund and how to pull the trigger on when to use it. Can you talk about what we can think about?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody needs to have an emergency fund just because it's important to have financial buffers, a buffer between you and, you know, financial ruin. You know, if you lose a job, you get in a car, you know, something happens to your car, you need to have reserves on hand to cover you, not just because of the money aspect, because, you know, you could put that on a credit card and pay it off or whatever, but just having that fund there and knowing that you're going to be okay is everything. Like, that just changes your whole approach to money. You feel in control. You feel like you have some power. And I think most of us feel the exact opposite when it comes to money. We feel like money controls us. It controls all of our day-to-day decisions. So having something as simple as, like, you know, even when I was starting my emergency fund, I think I saved, you know, I saved like $1,000 or something that wasn't a lot, but it made me feel like, okay, maybe I can do this money thing. I have some kind of sense of control over my finances. So I think, you know, everybody should have something like that. As far as when to use it and when not to use it, I mean, I think there are some things that we inherently kind of know are emergencies and some things that we think are emergencies but might not be. And I talk about, like, some really specific examples of this in my book. But, you know, even in the case of, like, if your car breaks down, you know, one question I would ask is this something that you need right now? Could you, or is there another option available for you? What are your other options for emergency options? Could you, you know, take the bus? Could you take public transportation? Maybe your answer to that is no. But if it's yes, then maybe you hold on to your emergency fund while you save up for that car repair, something like that. So, you know, it's not always completely obvious when you should and shouldn't use your emergency fund. I think a lot of times people think the rules are very cut and dry like that. But I think as long as you're thinking in terms of, like, you know, what are my other options when I'm in this state of emergency? Or is this something something that I need to address immediately. I would say any health concerns are usually something you want to address immediately because that might end up costing you more, which is another question to ask before you use your emergency fund. Like, if I ignore this problem right now, is it going to cost me even more down the road? In that case, I might want to take care of it now.
You mentioned your emergency fund giving you a feeling of control, and you write that some people look at the overall economy, student loan debt up. A lot of things are beyond people's control, the job market, wages, things like that. And that might dishearten people, discourage people from trying to control their own finances. You say, no, actually, it's the opposite. That makes it more important to control what you can.
Yeah, I think so, because I think there are, especially nowadays, so many factors outside of our control that are kind of working against us, which is why I think it's more important than ever to think about the things and find the things that we can control, even if it's some small decision you have, because any way that you can take back power is going to be important. Even if it's, I was talking to somebody the other day and he was saying, you know, it's so stupid, but like the saying no to this $3 latte, the latte factor, right? Like just saying no to that made him feel like he was making decisions about his own financial life, which was everything. It's such a dumb little thing, you know, decision, simple decision you can make, but it makes a big difference to your psyche. Even if you can save five extra dollars a week. I know a lot of people who are like, I can't even, you know, I can't save money for retirement, so why bother? But I would say even if you can save $5 a week, it's not even the $5. Like, okay, maybe that might add up. It might not be a lot, but it does a lot to your mindset. And it kind of gets you in this mode of like, okay, there is something that I can do about my financial situation, however small it may be. And I think in those times where you feel powerless, it's more important than ever to look at what options you do have available.
I want to get into one more piece of advice that you talk about in the book, and that's selecting a bank. You say not enough of us shop around. What should we shop around for? What should we look for in a financial institution?
Well, one thing I'm really surprised about is how many people are still at a bank that charges them a monthly maintenance fee. Because there are so many, and I think people are a little bit cautious about online-only banks. But, you know, I use an online-only bank. I know a lot of other personal finance writers and kind of money nerds in the space that are all about online-only banks or just banks that don't charge you a monthly maintenance fee or some kind of, you know, a lot of times they'll say like, oh, you have to have X amount in your bank account or we're going to charge you this fee. You know, there are so many, like Bankrate is a good site where you can use to compare different banks or credit unions that are not necessarily going to charge you that. I think NerdWallet is another site. You can just go and kind of compare different banks so you can, you know, look for something that's not going to charge you that fee and it's not going to charge you to hold your money there, which they shouldn't, you know.
And as we wrap up, Kristen, in our last minute or so, how can we break the silence? How can we start talking, you know, even just among friends about these money issues?
One thing I think is, you know, first to surround yourself with people who are comfortable talking about it, right? Because you don't necessarily want to go up to some, you know, a friend you've just met and or a first date or something and say, how much money do you make? That might be a little awkward.
True.
But I think surrounding yourself with like-minded people and just kind of asking the question when you feel comfortable with your friends. You know, with my friends, one thing we started asking each other is, you know, how much do you save for retirement? It's not something that we talked about openly before. Writing a book about money helps with that. You know, people want to talk to you about it more. But I think just bringing up the conversation around, you might be surprised if you start talking about money openly, how okay other people are with it and how appreciative they will be to just have that conversation with somebody.
Yeah, briefly, do you get a sense of relief when people can finally start talking about money?
Yes, I kind of geek out on it, of course, but when people start talking about openly, I get into it. I'm like, yes, I think it's very important with salary transparency, too. I have a lot of, you know, as a writer, I'm in a lot of, you know, groups with writer friends where we talk very openly about how much we charge and how much we make. And a lot of people in that group, including me, sometimes are like, oh, I didn't know I could charge this much. And just having that conversation is so eye-opening.
We'll leave it there for now. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's Kristen Wong. Her new book is called Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. Drinking water hasn't been a huge issue in the race for governor, but for the residents of Kewaunee County, it's everything. The county has become a poster child of sorts for water quality concerns in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading reports on what the state has done to address the problem and how the candidates for governor say they deal with it.
Every day, Erica Balza fills up the coffee pot from a water cooler for her husband at their home in Luxembourg.
And get it ready for him so he can make his coffee for the next morning.
She says any water they drink or use for cooking doesn't come from the tap.
Anything that goes inside is going to be water out of the water cooler.
Balza doesn't trust her well water is safe to drink. 2 years ago, her husband turned on the shower before bed and the water came out brown.
And it just stunk. It smelled like manure. It was pure manure.
Families like Balza's have been helped by state government under Governor Scott Walker's administration. The question for some is whether Walker's Department of Natural Resources acted soon enough and whether it's done enough to help. Walker's DNR formed a work group to address water contamination several years ago. But that only happened after environmental groups and residents pushed for an investigation into why a third of wells tested above state and federal health standards for nitrates and bacteria. A 2-year study in the county followed that found 60% of wells tested had signs of waste from cows and people. Researcher Maureen Muldoon with UW Oshkosh worked on the study.
There are times of the year where the majority of the impacted wells are seeing bovine contamination, and there are times of the year where there's more human contamination than bovine contamination.
But Muldoon says the amount of contamination is usually bigger for cows, which outnumber people there 5-1. The research led to new state standards for manure spreading in eastern Wisconsin that were approved by Walker. They banned farms with less than 2 feet of soil from spreading manure due to the region's sensitive geology. While the new rules made farming more complicated, the Wisconsin Farm Bureau supports them. Paul Zimmerman is the group's lobbyist.
I know from the farm community, we do not want groundwater contamination. I mean, farmers don't want to have wells contaminated because it could be their own well. They, they live there and their family lives there. So farmers in general do not want groundwater contamination.
Kewaunee County conservationist Davina Bonas supports the new state rules, too. She says the county recently passed an ordinance so they would have more power to enforce state standards at the local level.
Bringing it all to the county and giving it the responsibility to the county and not having to rely on the DNR, who's also extremely understaffed and very stretched thin for their resources, it kind of just gives us local control of that.
It's that DNR staffing that has come under scrutiny in the race for governor. Critics argue DNR staff and funding cuts under Walker's administration have led to lax enforcement and oversight of water quality. Democrat Tony Evers says those cuts and limits on local control are the root cause of the state's problems with drinking water.
The result was we have a Department of Natural Resources that, frankly, is not science-based anymore, making decisions for the people of Kewaunee County, and it's just ridiculous.
Evers says he would increase staff and funding for the DNR and provide low-cost loans to help address well contamination statewide. Governor Walker's campaign spokesman said in a statement that Walker would work to make sure all families have access to safe drinking water. Erica Balza says a state grant paid for 75% of the cost to replace her well, and a local nonprofit group paid for the rest.
Some people have $14,000 on hand, but we don't, especially with medical bills.
But Balza says she'd like the state to do more to enforce rules that protect drinking water so that stories like hers don't become more common in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.